Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, the great orators of history, those people who have educated us and inspired us and persuaded us, they've all left this world a little different from how they found it. And sometimes it's for good, and of course, sometimes that's actually for ill. How have they changed history? And why were their speeches so effective? That's the question that's on my mind. And that's why Alan Whitaker is here, because he's going to answer them for us. He knows everything there is to know about oratory. It's good to have you here, Alan.
Well, I don't know about that, Sheridan, but I'll do my best.
The book that you've written is Speeches That Shaped the World. Speeches That Reshaped the World is actually the concise edition. Congratulations on the book. I mean, it's really, both books are quite a treasure trove of information about great oratory.
It was a lot of fun going back over history and finding those speeches that I think have stood the test of time. Some of them are very easy to grab, such as Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, or the speech that's in this volume, his final speech before his death. Kennedy, American presidents, of course, dominate. But it's also good to go back and get some of the more obscure speeches and look at how they really moved people to action.
Well, I want to look at orators in a time of war, in a time of mourning, in a time of change, in a time of apology. You mentioned MLK, Martin Luther King. I think you only have to play anything of what he's actually said and you get the idea that oratory can be incredibly powerful.
I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
I don't think it ever fails to move you whenever you hear him speak. I mean, you know, we've got to remember the context too. That was 1968. That was the night before he was assassinated. It was actually very prophetic what he was saying.
Well, I think he knew that there were issues that were going to come to a head in America. He had been at the forefront of the civil rights movement since the late 50s. But looking back through the lens of history, you know now that he was running out of steam. He was being attacked even by elements within his own party and his own followers. But it was almost like he just let everything loose that night. And it was almost like he felt that his life's work were coming to an end. But 40 years after the fact, you know, that speech still tingles and still inspires.
What made him so great? I mean, what are the elements there? There's no doubt that he was a master of pause. He didn't actually rush anything that he had to say.
Well, he was a preacher. So yeah, I think he had a lot of practice and a lot of education behind how he spoke and what he spoke about. But I think it's alchemy. It's the combination of his charisma, the person that he was, the delivery, the very educated, eloquent style of his prose, but also what he said. And, you know, he couldn't but be successful in the fact that he rooted what he said in the teachings of Jesus. And also he very much followed the teachings of Gandhi, the non-aggression, the passive resistance.
And I think, got it from Jesus.
Yeah, and I think he was able to cut through racial barriers, nationalities. And I think the thing that most people don't appreciate was how young he was. He was only in his 30s. He was 39 when he died. You know, where are the 30-year-olds now that are leading us with that sort of rhetoric? They're just not there. And he's one in a lifetime sort of orator.
All right, let's go to an old man then. When we think of oratory in a time of war, I think there's very few people who would not think of this piece of oratory.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Winston Churchill on the outbreak of World War II, you know, and you listen to him. He's got a lisp. He's not very polished. His diction is atrocious. And yet, what is it that makes that so galvanizing?
I think it's a paternal voice at a time when the world was on the brink of war, a lot of uncertainty. He was almost like the father's voice coming through the radio. And I think Part of his success was the fact that radio was such a powerful medium in the 30s. So you had this resonating voice, you know, very calmly talking about what they were going to do. And if you have a look at the text of his speech, and that's one of the joys of putting it in a book such as this, you know, what he's saying is very logical and very well thought out and very precise. So I think it alleviated a lot of fear in the minds of the Australian people on the other side of the world during the 1930s and 40s, but also the English people.
This is Open House right across the nation. Alan Whittaker is the author of Speeches That Reshaped the World. It's a collection of, how many is it actually in the new version? There's two versions of the book.
Yes, this version, there's 60 speeches over the last 100 years.
And we're just playing little snippets out of some of those that are actually in there. But of course, you've got the whole speech in there, and it's a great repository there of great oratory that really has changed and shaped history and changed the world that we actually now live in. We've got Churchill there, but of course, you know, in the book, you've also got the monsters alongside the heroes as well. And so you've actually got Hitler's address from 1939, but you've got this monster of evil. He was a great orator, though.
He was able to move people. I don't know how great an orator he was in the context of what he was saying. In fact, I get very confused reading Hitler's speeches now that they're all translated. They're on the net. This one, though, the Ossa Salzburg speech, is very clear in his intentions in invading Poland and believing that England was going to hold off retaliating for the next 2 years. He was wrong, of course. But he was very, very charismatic in his own way. What was seen on film, what was seen on radio, again, he was almost like a performer. And so you're looking at a nation of people who had been beaten in World War One. Their national pride had been hurt. There was deep depression, economic depression in Germany. He was able to galvanize all those different forces. Unfortunately, he led them in a different path. He led them on a path to ruin. The world suffered as a result. But I think it's important that when we're looking at great oratory and we're looking at oratory that moves people, that we also put the villains in there as well. He certainly was one of the great orators of the last 100 years, but for the wrong reasons.
Okay, the orator in a time of mourning. You've included US President Ronald Reagan, who gave this very moving speech after the 1986 Challenger disaster.
The crew of the space shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
What made him so listenable? I mean, there's a lot of emotion in that address, isn't there?
Well, he was a consummate actor. He was a great actor. But he was also another person who could deliver a great speech. And, you know, disregarding his policies, whether you agreed with his politics or not, he was able to deliver that speech. The other thing is, in one of the stories I talk about in the book, is that quote towards the end, that was actually from a poem that was given to him by Tyrone Power, who also served in the Air Force during the war. And it was written by a young bombardier who had been killed in the conflict. And the fact that Reagan was able to pull that out 40 years after the fact and say, I want this inserted in the speech. I'm going to say this at the end of the speech. And that's the line of the speech that most people remember.
How do you measure authenticity when it comes to oratory? Because we've just talked about Reagan was actually an actor, and yet there seemed to be, or I hope so, there was an authenticity there. There was an empathy about what the nation was actually going through at the time of the Challenger disaster. How do you measure it? Do you think it can simply be whipped up, that it can be created in a way that we just never know? It really is just an act?
No, I think you've just got to measure the man's sincerity in the delivery. And let's face it, world leaders have to play that role of leading the mourning. The Governor General did it here in Australia. Kevin Rudd has recently done it with the bushfires in Australia. And they've got to play that role. They've got to be that role. But I think we can tell through the sincerity of the delivery, not only what's being said, sometimes a simple, I'm sorry, is enough, but it's in the sincerity of the delivery. And I don't think you can doubt Reagan's sincerity. It was really an event that touched the whole world, and he was the leader of the free world, calming everybody and leading the mourning, and I think he did a great job.
Okay, the orator in time of change. You've included Nelson Mandela's speech from his 1964 trial.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
Prepared to die for his cause, 1964, Nelson Mandela, as he was...
That's an amazing snip. I don't know where you got that from. But
found it on YouTube, of all places.
Yeah, that's actually the Rivonia trial where he was sentenced to life imprisonment. They could have given him the death penalty, but they realised that it was going to be a huge backlash. They gave him life. He was never to be released. But as we now know, in the 1990s, apartheid hadn't worked, and the release of Mandela actually precipitated the fastest change, I think, in our lifetime. Mm. You know, within 18 months, they were holding free elections. The ANC had been elected to rule after 100 years of white minority rule. And here was Mandela at the forefront of it, not only calming the white populist, but also the black populist.
Well, that's right. I've actually fought against, you know, black supremacy as well as white supremacy.
Yeah, I think he realised that they couldn't come out and take care of all the retribution that needed to be done over 100 years of injustice. And once again, very much rooted in the ideals of Jesus and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, here we have this cycle again of non-aggression, of forgiveness, and looking towards the future. And that's, I think, the mark of a real visionary, and Mandela was.
Yes. It was interesting, as I was looking for some of the clips that actually relate to a good deal of these speeches you have in the books, that so many of them actually did have some sort of spiritual element in them. A lot of them actually did quote scripture. John F. Kennedy actually quoted scripture in his 1968 or 1961 address, actually, that you've got in the current book. Then, of course, you had Reagan, who often would quote scripture. Now, of course, part of that is cultural, and the fact that these countries have had a bit of Christian influence. But it was interesting. Even if they weren't Christians themselves, they were actually, you know, like Gandhi, actually were influenced by the person of Jesus.
I think we have to be fair and say that the Christian message has stood the test of time over 2,000 years. In fact, in the introduction to the first volume of speeches in 2005, I talked about Jesus and the Beatitudes, and the fact that even if you dismissed the idea of Jesus as God, looking at Jesus as teacher, here's a teaching that has lasted 2,000 years. And it's no wonder many of our leaders have tapped into the gospel and to Christian values. Of course, many of the charlatans and the villains have also done so for their own good as well. Mm. And I think it's about the connection with the public. And I think people can understand the Christian message because it's a message of forgiveness, building the kingdom, if you will. And I think that's why so many leaders do tap into that, because it's a positive message.
Mm. You included Mandela's speech in 1964. You also included in the book the 1990 statement by South African President F.W. de Klerk, who actually released, finally, was the one, I guess, under his watch. That's when Mandela was released.
Well, the publishers are a South African company. New Holland Publishers, their home base is in South Africa. And so the first volume was released in South Africa, and I actually had some letters from South Africa. I'm very unaccustomed to getting fan mail, but I got a couple of letters from South Africa basically asking me, I had a Mandela speech in the first volume but no de Klerk speech, and how could I justify putting Mandela in but not de Klerk? And I thought, well, in the second volume, I'll put them side by side each other so that people can see. I did respond to one of the letters and say, well, which is the greatest injustice, a man being jailed for 28 years for standing up for his homeland, or the man releasing him after 28 years? I think there is a place for both. I think F.W. de Klerk was a great statesman and a great politician, but he was also a smart politician. He realised that the tide had turned against apartheid. The world tide had turned against them, and it was actually hurting the minority government, the minority white populace of South Africa. So the time had come. not many people can see the writing on the wall and change, and at least de Klerk did see that.
Mm. This is Open House Across the Nation, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast of our chat with Alan Whittaker. He's the author of Speeches That Reshaped the World. We're talking about great orators and how, for good or ill, their words have changed the world that you and I actually live in now. Okay, finally, the orator in a time of apology. Who can go past this little piece of oratory?
We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these our fellow Australians. We apologise especially for the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, their communities and their country. For the pain, suffering and hurt of these stolen generations, their descendants, and for their families left behind, we say sorry.
Kevin Rudd's 2008 historic apology to Indigenous Australians. What made it so good?
I think it was just a wonderful speech. I think timing.
Been a long time coming, hadn't it?
Had been a long time coming, but it's grabbing the time. And I think the first symbolic thing that he wanted to do with his new government was to apologise. Regardless of whether or not you agree with Rudd's politics, it was recommended by an independent body that the Australian government apologise as the first step of reconciliation. Now, Howard refused to take that step for whatever reasons. With Rudd, he forgot about all that. And he just took the time to apologise on behalf of the nation and on behalf of the people that voted him in, but on behalf of all Australians. And whether you agree with it or not, I think 18 months after the fact, we know it was the right thing to do.
And Prime Minister Rudd actually did write that one himself. It wasn't a scriptwriter.
No, he did. And he did a very good job of it too. Very succinct, clear, no equivocation, no hyperbole, but it was just a plain, clear apology on behalf of the Australian governments today and past.
So you've compiled 60 of these great kind of historical speeches in the current book. There's even more in the original book that actually is much larger, covers a much larger time span as well. What have you learned, Alan, about what makes a great piece of oratory, what makes a great speech?
Well, I think it's a number of things. First of all, it's timing. It's the context of history. We remember Kennedy's speech because we're at a time when we needed that speech. We'll remember Rudd. We'll remember many of the speeches in the books because they reflect the time. Secondly, it's the person giving the speech. Many of these speakers, Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, they're some of the most charismatic leaders the world has seen. But lastly, it's what's in the speech. We remember Kennedy because what he said. We remember Kennedy for when he said, you know, ask not what your country can do for you. That's the line that we remember. So there has to be some substance to the speech. So if we take the context of history, the person delivering the speech, and the message that is being said, and we weave that together with some sort of alchemy, some sort of chemistry, then they make the greatest speeches of all time.
Well, Alan, we didn't have any of the females. You've actually got a whole section of female orators there, and I couldn't find any clips for them, but there's a whole section of them there in the book. So thanks for coming in as well. It's been great to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Alan Whittaker, who's the author of Speeches That Reshaped the World through New Holland Publishers.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.